Bonjour et bienvenue à tous. Et merci d'avoir été assez courageux pour braver cette soudaine pluie de mousson dans notre ciel parisien pour venir jusqu'ici. Nous avons le plaisir et l'honneur d'accueillir aujourd'hui le professeur Peter Zarrow, que je connais depuis pas mal d'années, parce que je crois que le professeur Zarrow a eu la gentillesse de m'impliquer dans un volume collectif qu'il mettait en forme à l'époque. Je crois que c'était il y a à peu près une vingtaine d'années, en fait. I'm saying that we met something like 20 years ago,
something like
I suppose.
That.
Yeah, I was trying to reckon. Mm-hmm. Anyway. Et c'était mon rêve, justement, de le faire venir à Paris. Et en réalité, c'est mon collègue de l'EHESS, Sébastien Vey, qui est assis ici, qui a réalisé ce rêve en invitant le professeur Zarrow à passer un mois à l'EHESS, où il donnera d'autres conférences, dont je vous donnerai le détail dans un instant. Alors, le professeur Zarrow a été formé à l'université Columbia, à New York, où il a obtenu son PhD, donc son doctorat. Et ensuite, il a passé pas mal d'années donc à Taïwan, à la prestigieuse Academia Sinica de Taïwan, où il est encore associé, chercheur associé, donc dans le département de, enfin dans l'institut d'histoire moderne, tout en ayant une chaire de professeur d'histoire à l'université du Connecticut aux États-Unis. Il est spécialiste de l'histoire de la Chine, de la fin de l'Empire et des débuts de la République, donc ça nous situe à la fin du 19e au début du 20e siècle. Et il a publié un certain nombre de volumes importants, en particulier des monographies qui ont porté sur des sujets tels que l'anarchisme chinois. Je pense à ce volume intitulé Anarchism and Chinese Political Culture, donc l'anarchisme et la culture politique chinoise, publié à Columbia en 1990. Il a également étudié donc le concept d'empire dont on parle tellement actuellement, et l'évolution de la théorisation politique de l'État chinois, en particulier dans le volume intitulé After Empire, The Conceptual Transformation of the Chinese State, 1885 to 1924, publié à Stanford en 2012, donc ça veut dire après l'Empire, la transformation conceptuelle de l'État chinois entre 1885 et 1924. Et plus récemment, il s'est intéressé au manuel scolaire en Chine, sujet également important et ô combien controversé, notamment dans les pays d'Asie de l'Est. Il y a justement ces disputes qui durent encore aujourd'hui entre le Japon, la Chine, la Corée. Ce volume s'intitule « Educating China, Knowledge, Society and Textbooks in a Modernizing World, 1902 to 1937 », publié à Cambridge en 2015, c'est-à-dire donc éduquer la Chine, connaissances, société et manuel scolaire, donc dans un monde en modernisation, 1902-1937. Et il est également l'auteur d'un manuel de référence en anglais sur cette période, volume qui s'intitule China in War and Revolution, 1895 to 1949, publié par Routledge en 2005, donc la Chine en guerre et en révolution entre 1895 et 1949. Donc là, vous reconnaissez des dates vraiment très importantes de l'histoire chinoise moderne. Et je ne mentionne pas le très grand nombre d'articles, aussi bien en anglais qu'en chinois, qu'a publié le professeur Zarrow sur les intellectuels de la fin des Qing, donc de la fin de la période manchoue, comme Kang Youwei, dont il sera question aujourd'hui, et Liang Qichao, son principal disciple. Il y a également un grand nombre d'articles sur la pensée politique, l'anarchisme, le marxisme, le libéralisme, et notamment le concept d'utopie, dont il sera justement question aujourd'hui, et également des concepts historiographiques comme la citoyenneté. Donc là, vous voyez que nous sommes vraiment dans quelque chose dont vous voyez tout de suite les enjeux actuels, enfin dans le contexte actuel. J'annonce rapidement donc les autres conférences que va donner le professeur Zarrow à Paris. Donc aujourd'hui, il s'agira de parler de The Ambiguous Utopianism of Kang Youwei, donc l'utopisme ambigu de Kang Youwei, donc ce très grand lettré de la fin de la période manchoue et du début de l'époque républicaine, dont les dates sont 1858-1927. Et qui a fait l'objet d'un séminaire ici au Collège de France, mené par Béatrice Laridon, donc ma collègue de Paris Diderot, et moi-même. Nous avons lu donc une grande partie du commentaire de Kang Youwei sur le fameux chapitre Li Yun du Li Ji, du traité des rites. Donc c'est un petit peu l'année Kang Youwei qui se termine en beauté avec la conférence du professeur Zarrow. Et ensuite, dès demain, mercredi 22 mai, à 13h, le professeur Zarrow donnera une conférence à l'EHESS au 54 boulevard Raspail. Vous trouverez, je pense, tous les détails sur le site de l'EHESS, intitulé « Forbidden City and Meiji Shrine, East Asian Memory Construction in the Early 20th Century », donc la cité interdite et le sanctuaire Meiji, la mémoire d'Asie orientale, enfin la construction de la mémoire dans l'Asie orientale du début du XXe siècle. Ensuite, lundi prochain, le 27 mai à 14h, toujours à l'EHSS 54 boulevard Raspail, il y aura une autre conférence sur Modern State Building on Imperial Foundations in China and Japan, donc la construction de l'État moderne sur des fondations impériales en Chine et au Japon. Et enfin, donc le mercredi 5 juin à 10h, toujours au même endroit, donc il y aura une présentation sur les Utopian Strands in the Formation of Chinese Liberalism 1915-1940, donc des tendances utopiques dans la formation du libéralisme chinois entre 1915 et 1940. Donc là. Ah oui, bien. Alors donc voilà, là straight from the horse's mouth. Donc voilà, donc bien. Avant de laisser la parole au professeur Zarrow, donc il y a ce rite propre au Collège de France de remettre une médaille souvenir en gage de notre reconnaissance et
merci beaucoup. Thank you very much. I will begin again by thanking Professor An Cheng for today's invitation and Sebastian Begg for inviting me to Paris for this month. Perhaps I will cut myself off by 3:20 at the latest and ask you for questions, comments, and criticisms. I should say the talk I'm giving today is from a book manuscript that I have basically finished on on utopian thought in modern China, which basically has to begin, I think, with Kong Youwe. So when Professor Cheng and I first met 20 or more years ago, I was working on Kong Youwe, and then for a long time I wasn't, but now I have been again. So that's what I'm going to talk about. For reasons that I will explain, I hope there's ambiguity in Kong's utopianism. Then also, I think central to the way I want to think about it is through Kong's identity, or rather self-identity, as a Confucian literatus, which is to say, he was, or thought he was, a master of classical learning in this Confucian tradition, while at the same time his own exegeses and commentaries were sometimes very arbitrary, even verged on the bizarre. So we have to explain that. And he's also fairly familiar with Buddhist writings, and in his way he was an avid consumer of Western texts in translation. To put the different facets of Kong together, you have to think about his classical training in Confucianism and his inclinations in that way, but also perhaps think of himself, think of him in terms he rarely himself used, but as a kind of religious prophet. People at the time, some at least, thought this was the best way to think about him. And he was also a political activist. Throughout his entire career from the 1880s, most importantly in the 1890s, and until his death in the early 20th century as well. As a political activist in the late 1880s and 1890s, these slogans, I think, summarized his approach to radical institutional reform, something that went beyond the early reformist efforts, but he wanted nothing to do with revolution. His models for the empire of the day were the Meiji Emperor of Japan and Peter the Great in Russia. As you know, this was a time, several generations of so-called domestic disturbances and foreign intrusions, which continued well through Kong's own lifetime. So as I say, this was his identity. He not only wrote a great deal, but practiced calligraphy, poetry, and was generally well-read. It is important, I think, to note Kong's birthplace. This is not going to work. In southeast China, very near what is now the huge metropolis of Canton there toward the coast, and near Hong Kong, which he visited several times as a young man. So this is a city that had the longest and most intimate acquaintance with the West, where missionaries from Britain and America and France especially had established themselves for some time. His great utopian work is the Da Teng Shu, or what I like to translate as the Book of the Great Commonweal. It could be translated, I think, in any number of ways. More or less finished by 1902, though in ways begun already by the 1880s. There's nothing ambiguous about the fact that it is clearly a utopia. If we think of utopias as a literary genre, however, they have either been centered on far distant islands, and we're suddenly presented with this perfect world, or set in a far distant future. What Kong's utopia does that's a little different from the standard genre of utopia is to explain in some detail of how we get from here today to this place he places in the future of a world in its perfection that I'll describe in a minute. What is ambiguous about it, however, is how it relates to Kong's self-proclaimed Confucianism, to his very cautious politics, and especially in terms of the text itself, there's an inbuilt ambiguity in how Kong presented his historical vision of how, as I say, how we get from today to this very vague point in the distant future. I want to suggest that Kong's belief in progress, but gradual progress that moves through set stages, meant that his utopian vision was simultaneously radical but also conservative. It inspired an important generation of disciples in the 1890s, but in the new politics of revolution, in the post-revolutionary stage of the 19-teens and 1920s, Kong inevitably became known as a conservative or even a reactionary. It's almost as if his views never fit the times. He was either too far ahead or too far behind. During most of his lifetime, he attempted to keep his utopian vision as a kind of esoteric knowledge, not published. None of it was published until after the revolution. It was published in 1913 and only partly published at that time. What he would say was then, this is knowledge that he would make available to his disciples, but the world was not yet ready for it. I want to look at sort of more specific ambiguities or tensions in Kong's thought, one being the vision of the ancient so-called three dynasties as a kind of golden age, and yet, how does that correspond to the notion of linear progress that Kong undoubtedly believed in? Another is his particular, even peculiar vision of Confucius as a prophet who literally foretold the future. But on the other hand, the future he also saw as a creation, as a human construct, as something people will build through the ages. Then you have his truly radical beliefs, including, for example, abolition of the family. Not a very Confucian-sounding belief. And how can this relate to the moderate political positions and kind of general social conservatism that he proclaimed in public? Well, one way is to say simply the world is not ready for the great utopia, for the Datong. But curiously then, the world is not even ready for knowledge of his concept of the Datong. So you have his goals of absolute equality, with ratio of race, gender, and class, ultimately equality even of species, nothing special about humans. And through this growth of development of the Datong, then, of course, you get to the stage of world government based on democratic order. At the same time, he's promoting a kind of top-down vision of reform through institutions promulgated by a strong central government via an educated, essentially Confucian class of literati. So, what I'll do today, very quickly then, is talk about a little more about Kong's utopian vision as something he formulated in the years before the revolution of 1911. Then, very, very briefly, his position in China in the wake of the revolution of 1911 in the 19-teens. And then finally, I want to say a few words about a kind of revival of Kongyawe today, which is strange, to me at least, because historians of China have pretty much treated Kong as a marginal figure, a man of briefly some influence in the 1890s, but who then fades out of the picture very quickly. That's if you look at textbooks of China, if he appears at all, it will be for this brief moment of political reform in the late 1890s, yet a reform that failed utterly at the time at least, and after which he disappears from the pages of history. But now he's back, so I'll briefly look at that as well. The historical context of Kong's lifetime is important to keep in mind. This was a time of turmoil and danger. He's not some kind of armchair philosopher, but a man provoking political disputes. By 1897, there were calls for his execution that were ignored, but nonetheless were going to the imperial government. And this even while very little of Kong's radical utopianism would have been widely known. In the historical context of the early republic, after the revolution overthrew the Qing dynasty, it's a time of political chaos, arguably of moral spiritual decline. This is Kong's interpretation in particular, which led him to promotion of a Confucian church. What he called Kung Jiao, of Confucian teachings, which he thought should be modeled on the state religions, for example, the Church of England in Britain. And then, as I say, I'll say a few words about Kong's revival today, how it links to reformism in China today, and the question of utopianism. So for Kongyawe, his vision of linear progress was rooted in this notion of the three ages, which he's taking from the classics, where it's generally thought to refer to a notion of decline, and he's turning it upside down into a notion of progress. So I won't say much more about that, except of particular importance is the classical text, the Liyuan chapter of the Li Ji, that I think some of you know much more about than I do. The chapter in one translation reads this way: in the practice of the Great Way, all under heaven was public. We don't have to go through this whole text at the moment. The key term that Kong took from it is Da Tong there. What I'm translating is Great Commonweal. It also means something like enormous, I want to say assimilation, commonality, what is being shared. Essentially, Kong postulated that the three ages, as foretold or even established by Confucius, was a form of gradual evolutionism. So clearly Kong is influenced by Western views of progress, that he then rests on his interpretation of the classics. So from chaos, it's not quite clear if this describes the present age or an age past, into the age of lesser peace, that might describe the present age, or maybe an age once constitutionalism is established politically. And then finally, the great Commonweal. This is a notion that I think was extremely influential, again for a brief moment, until for most intellectuals in China, it was replaced by visions of social Darwinism, of competition and the struggle to survive, the weak will perish. That's a vision that influenced Kong slightly, but he never fully bought into. He's not ultimately a social Darwinist. His vision of progress is more benign than that. The language that he used is still with us today. So an ordinary way to talk about utopia in the Chinese language is simply to say Da Tong. His notion of the second stage of progress, Xiao Kang, is sometimes used today to describe present-day China, which has become more prosperous than ever before in history. This is a language, I think, then, ultimately derived from Kang Youwei. Okay, let me look at this quotation from Kang Youwei, where he says very clearly how he's making his vision of Confucius central to his vision of a kind of cosmic progress. So it's a description of Confucius that would have been very, very unfamiliar to his peers in the 1880s and 1890s, who had, no place in their intellectual systems for the concepts of Da Tong, especially. Looking at his concepts of lay behind his utopianism, the foundation of his utopianism, there are any number you could choose from. I just want to list four here. The notion of universal principles, a right of autonomy, referring to individuals ultimately, Ren, humaneness, of which I'll say a few more words in a minute, and then, of course, a concept of progress. He believed that humans cannot bear to see suffering, whether their own or another person's. This is a familiar concept to all Confucians coming from Mencius in the classical period. Then Kang also believed in the universal capacity among humans for intelligence and ethical behavior. But he thought this capacity for intelligence had been suppressed historically by Chinese institutions, at least for millennia. Intelligence, he ultimately thought, is by no means limited to sages or highly educated gentlemen, but does find its fullest expression among them. So they do have a natural leadership role in society. If you think about Kang's social position at the time of his writings, he's giving a special role to literati like himself and his disciples as the natural leaders of society. Nonetheless, looking at the time, let me move on. When we come to the first open publication of the Great Commonwealth in 1913, it's just the first two chapters. Chapter on suffering and how knowledge of suffering leads to the desire to make the world a better place. And then he published in 1913 this first chapter, really, of abolishing national boundaries. And the rest of the book, known among a circle of the disciples, but not really widely known in detail at least, is not published till after his death. The key that I want to bring out in this translation of the different chapters is the notion of abolishing boundaries. So by abolishing boundaries, you create unity. Another plausible translation of the concept of Da Tong is of great unity. And as I say, a kind of sharingness. It is, of course, when you think about abolishing boundaries of gender, which is, say, equality of the sexes, actually abolishing the family as an institution, abolishing races one way or another, it's pretty radical and perhaps leads us far beyond the bounds of Confucianism. If you look at the last two chapters, abolishing boundaries of kind and loving all living things, abolishing boundaries of suffering and attaining utmost happiness. This actually, I'll speak more about this in a minute, this actually goes beyond the Datong. He says, after the Datong, after the great commonweal is achieved, history does not stop, but rather the evolution of living beings continues. And human beings in particular will ultimately all become Buddhas. So again, we've somehow moved far, far beyond the bounds of anything you normally think of as Confucianism. Also, if you think of the Datong Shu as a utopia, which I do, again, it's unusual as part of the genre insofar as it does not present a world that's fixed and finished. Having achieved perfection, nothing more is going to happen, but rather that he sees progress in some sense as continuing in perpetuity. So, in sum, a world without any distinctions of nation, class, race, gender, a world government made of decentralized democratic organs, a generally homogeneous world, though a world leading ultimately to complete love and liberation from all suffering. Among perhaps the influences behind Kong's thinking, in addition to what he explicitly took through his exegesis on the classics, were writings available to him in translation, science fiction writers, H.G. Wells and Jules Verne, and most importantly, probably Edward Bellamy. Edward Bellamy's utopia of the late 1880s had become extraordinarily popular across the world. It was almost immediately translated into something like 20 languages, and a bridge translation in Chinese appeared very quickly, and accessible to Kong would have been a longer, more complete Japanese translation. Bellamy, like Kong, is one of the few classic utopias that looks at the question of how we get from the conditions of today, miserable as they are, to a far superior future. It's worked out in Bellamy and it's worked out in Kong. I do want to say not all readers then or now will find Kong's utopia appealing, especially to modern eyes. It hardly celebrates difference, but is a kind of paean to cosmic assimilation. And perhaps most disturbing of all is his vision of how the black and so-called black and so-called brown races will disappear, because here he's turning to social Darwinism, they are not capable of survival into the modern era, whereas the yellow and white races will gradually amalgamate. I do want to then come back to the question of the principles behind the Book of Great Commonweal, especially this notion, very popular in the 1890s, early 1900s, of Gongli, universal principle, kind of absolute justice, standards applicable everywhere. And Kong's particular interpretation of the Confucian notion of Ren, usually translated humanity or humaneness, which he said was a shared primordial substance of heaven and earth. The premise being that the universe, the cosmos, is good and leading toward good, and hence then, of course, progress and greater human equality. Then, as I was suggesting, after the achievement of the Great Commonwealth, no more families, kind of worldwide democratic order, history, or cosmic processes continue to the point that equality encompasses all beings, from flies and cockroaches to human beings and the gods, and humans evolve into a kind of godlike state of the immortals. So this has been hard for scholars of Kong to make sense of, It's possible for us to imagine a kind of worldwide democratic order, at least if we really try. It's much harder to take the next mystical leap into where we all start literally flying around the cosmos. Okay. In the period between 1898, after his political involvement in a reform movement failed, and 1912, Kong was in exile with a price on his head. 1912, he came back to China and founded the Confucian Association. Let me leap ahead here. There's another parallel that strikes me between Kong Youwei and Edward Bellamy, and that is they were both, after working out their utopian visions, they both became politically involved in a kind of grassroots or NGO way. That is, Edward Bellamy founded what he called nationalist clubs to bring about his vision of the perfect world order. And Kong Youwei founded the Confucian Association, Confucian Church, and also something called the Dao De Hui, the Morality Society. These were both not exactly religious in the sense of requiring particular beliefs, but kind of vaguely spiritual and redemptive. So religiously syncretic, if you like, salvationist, but also very this-worldly oriented with a stake in political affairs and charitable practices on the grounds. The Confucian Association was in practice promoting the idea that the new Republic of China, founded in 1912, should establish a state religion, and that state religion should be Confucianism, and they should pay salaries to Confucian teachers across the land. Looking at the membership of the Confucian Association, you can see that it was inevitably quite a conservative body with leading national, political, and cultural figures among its membership. For the new generation of students in the 19-teens, then Kong Youwei has inevitably become a figure of symbolic of reactionary tendencies in the Chinese politics, and also a figure of some ridicule. So he's often sarcastically called the Sage Kong at this time. Thinking about Kong historically again, then, he had a fairly conventional education for the time. Generally Confucian, of course, as was not untypical of the mid and late 19th century. In terms of the various competing Confucian schools, the approach of his teachers were rather syncretic. In the 1880s, he begins to, I think, quite deliberately and consciously engage in activities that give him a reputation as a rather eccentric, extremist figure. For example, funeral ceremonies for his grandfather he attempted to carry out according to the strictures of classical texts of some 2,000 years earlier, involving days and months of ritual mortification that nobody had really engaged in for a long time. But he set up his own school and attracted a small but very talented number of disciples from the southeast part of China. 1895, again, is when he emerges into public consciousness as an important political figure in his own right. Organizing a protest against the Treaty of Shimonoseki, which gave territory and funds to Japan, which had defeated China in a war essentially over influence in Korea. This was an illegal act, according to the laws of the dynasty, for which there was no punishment whatsoever. And in fact, the associations that Kong sets up or helps to set up in 1895 flourish for the next few years, until in 1898, he participates. He has, one way or another, the ear of the emperor and promotes a set of reforms that did not directly yet call for China to become a constitutional monarchy, but would have been leading China in that direction had they not been halted in their steps by the Empress Dowager in the fall of 1898, after which, as I say, he was sent into exile or fled into exile and organized a society called the Society to Protect the Emperor, as opposed to the Empress Dowager, and continued then to promote reform among China's elites, as opposed to the growing influence of revolutionaries who eventually then came to power, or at least managed to overthrow the dynasty in 1911-1912. So then, as I say, after 1912, he comes back to China, but is really a very marginal figure. I mean, there is the Confucian Association, there is the Morality Society, but they're not part of the mainstream intellectual scene or even social or cultural scene. They're a home for people who think one way or another the revolution was a mistake, and if we could turn the clock back, we should. But of course, in fact, they couldn't. Okay, so there's Kong, and for a long time after Kong's death, he's not really thought of. He's just a marginal figure after this brief moment of glory in the late 1890s, a reform effort that again failed. So he's what my President Trump would call a loser. But there are moments of important recognition of Kong's importance to shaping modern Chinese culture. In the 1970s, Xiao Gongchuan's large biography of Kong emerged, and Xiao attempts, with some success, to put the different careers of Kong together. That is, Kong the Confucian scholar, Kong the political activist, though moderate, and Kong the visionary, whose visions were sometimes quite bizarre. In the 1980s, Zhang Hao's book on Chinese intellectuals came out with an important chapter on Kong that I think really explains the metaphysical basis, such as it was at least, of Kong's utopian vision. More recently, Evans Chan, a filmmaker from Hong Kong, produced a kind of documentary, fictionalized biography of Kong Youwei's life, emphasizing the centrality of his utopian vision to that life, called Da Tong, and that's the poster for the film you see there. And then in just the last few years, we have the Kong revival, of which I'll say just a few words. This almost seems to come out of nowhere. It comes out of the new Confucian movement in China today. So I'm calling these the new Confucians. New Confucianism as a school of thought might be traced back to the 19-teens, represented by scholars both on the mainland and then after the communist takeover, mostly by scholars in Hong Kong, Taiwan, and to some extent the West. The new Confucians of this diaspora group were concerned with philosophical issues, and in their way of thinking about Confucianism, there was no role for Kong Youwei whatsoever. But the new Confucians of the mainland say, actually, to them, Kang Youwei is a key figure. The problem with the diaspora New Confucians is precisely that they were interested in abstract philosophical notions, trying to work out how Confucianism and Kantianism and Hegel are related, questions not of interest to the mainland Confucians. The philosopher and Kang enthusiast Chen Ming, first on my list here, says what Kang Youwei is the first man to realize was the importance of institutions that would provide the Chinese with moral, cultural standards and a sense of national identity. And this is the role that properly belongs to Confucianism in the 20th century. It didn't work out in the 20th century, but now in the 21st century, that's what he wants Chinese to begin building. He has a great deal of respect for Kang's religiosity. And all of this, I think, is the core of the reason why Kang has suddenly emerged as relevant to Chinese today. Second man on the list, Chen Lai, is one of the most famous intellectual historians of Confucianism. Has in the last few years begun writing about more modern periods. In his view, Kang Youwei is really the first man to understand the nature of the challenge of modernity and westernization to Chinese civilization and Confucianism. So what Chinese need to do today is to look back to Kang as a kind of model of how to define China's role in the world today. It was Kang as the first man to realize that the Confucian scholarship of the imperial era needed a new institutional framework and state backing in the modern period. Unsentimentally, Chen Lai also notes that Kang Youwei's project failed. Maybe it can be revived. However, a different view is that of Tang Wenming, who argues it's not really that Kang Youwei's effort failed. So what we can do is think of Kang Youwei as a legislator in the sense promulgated by Rousseau. So the people who established modern China's political systems, Mao Zedong or Deng Xiaoping, are not the true legislators of China, but it's the vision of Kang Youwei that lies behind a new particular Chinese modernity that makes Kang the true legislator of China coming into the 21st century. Lying behind this, I think, not often spelled out quite explicitly, is a rejection of revolution, which is to say a rejection of the dominant mode of Chinese political discourse from the early 1900s through to the Communist Revolution, lasting in some ways even till today. So Kang Youwei is not only about reviving a Confucian church to establish an institutional basis for some kind of spirituality and morality, but represents the legitimacy of gradual, steady reform as opposed to revolution that produces all kinds of ill effects. Ganyang, then, of Sun Yat-sen University, is another representative of this way of thinking. Why? Well, again, it's very hard not to refer to the two faces of Kang Youwei, the practical political reformer and the universalist utopian. As to which face speaks to China today, it's clearly not the utopian thinker. When these intellectuals I list here and others speak about Kang Youwei today, they virtually never refer to his Datong thought. If they do, it's to emphasize Kong's own position that the world was not ready for the great common weal, but hundreds, thousands of years later, we can gradually get to there. So this is to claim Kong as a kind of political ancestor. Well, from my point of view, it's of course understandable that Chinese intellectuals today are allergic to revolution and to utopianism. It's also, legitimate for thinkers to just take what they find useful and discard the rest. To my knowledge, people today read Plato, but nobody really takes him whole. But there is a risk of distorting the kind of true Kongyo way. So as a historian, I don't want to do that. Kong's own view of his utopianism was certainly ambiguous. It represented to him, I think, dangerous knowledge, but nonetheless true and real knowledge. And I'll stop there and ask you for comments. Thank you very much. Mm-hmm.